This is the Are You Screwed podcast.
Hello, sir. This is Jonathan from Sears. Do you have a moment for a survey?
I'm sorry, I do not.
The Are You Screwed podcast.
Sir, just one question, if you don't mind.
Shut up, working on.
Sir, is your refrigerator running?
Give your picks and move on. This is Adam's segment, you idiot.
I will ruin Rutgers.
The Are You Screwed podcast.
Virtual reality sex machine.
Oh.
The freshman out of Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania.
The Are You Screwed podcast.
He's bitty bad.
Gianna.
Mike, get your picks ready.
Gianna.
I predict that I'm going to get blackout drunk at every tailgate so I don't have to watch the game.
Am I bringing this one in today or however I want to do it?
I can do it.
All right, just...
I'm ready for this moment.
Go ahead.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Can I bring it in?
Yes, you can.
Are we recording?
Is this you bringing it in?
Is this like it? Am I ready? Are we ready?
This is the beginning of the podcast.
Are You Screw Podcast?
Are you Bane?
Yeah, I tried to do the cool audio effects. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another podcast. We're back. We're not going to do a lot of talking this time. I kind of want to just cut to the gist of this podcast, which is a great interview, which maybe, Adam, since you set it up, you want to talk about just right off the top to wet their beaks.
This is like the first time in a while we've actually said who the guest is within the first minute of the show. Yeah, it's Hamidi Enjai. Also, another big announcement, too. We are off our like 1 week furlough.
We are.
From Rutgers.Rivals.com. Yeah, so go right now. Go check them out. Go premium today. I'm sure Richie and the guys have got some deal going on. So yeah, we are officially off. We were on furlough while we were taping last week's episode, but literally as the episode dropped, we were taken off furlough. So we're back.
Richie started sending us those checks with his big signature on it.
Yeah,
we just got furloughed so he could send out the checks.
Right. It was just a very, very short period.
I'm going to put up a poll. Did Richie forget?
That we were furloughed?
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
I did the polls is going to be, did Richie forget?
There was just some sweeping wave of, people coming to Rutgers.Rivals.com. And so we're back. Anyway,
Adam, I hate to interrupt you because I don't actually hate to.
Well, that's my thing.
Do you think we actually drove any business? Like, is this just all a canard?
I don't know. Why am I going to make an argument right now to once again go back on furlough? No, like, I'm not going to do that.
Of course, like, we're not premium content. No one's paying, like this isn't part of, like, their premium service or whatever. So,
but I did find it funny that Mike last week joked about the fact that the current events board was basically demolished and somehow our releasing of the episode last week and us talking about it on Rutgers.Rivals.com was by choice a political statement releasing the episode and the thing had to get locked.
Wait, what? Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying. Gotcha.
Yeah, by the way, locked? while we're the thread got locked.
Yeah, because I think like because they don't have anywhere to go for their like for the current events. This isn't a visual medium, but I'm putting it in quotes. So they saw an opportunity to say, cut out the political BS.
That's true. We did.
Done listening. Stop listening. Tired of every episode having the political BS. Except, yeah, buddy, you listen to every single episode and you know about the political BS. And so I thank them for all of his past downloads, his current download, and all of his future downloads because that guy is not going to stop listening. So hello, guy on the message boards. Hello. How are you?
Richie, by the way, just texted me right now while we're taping this. Put that tweet out. He's like, what happened? I was like, long story, man. It'll come on out in the episode, so don't worry about that.
It's not a bad reflection on Richie.
No, it's not, but obviously, can you blame him?
No,
we know what we do.
Wait, can you make this a poll, Max? Sure. The poll should just say, are you confused when we randomly tweet things during a live taping and don't know what it is? Is that too long?
So what do you want
to
say?
Just make that the question. Are you confused when we randomly make poll questions during a live taping and you don't know what we're talking about yet?
When we're making a live taping.
This is the good radio.
So anyway, so this episode is largely going to be filled with the Hamidi Enjai interview. It is over an hour long. It is really good. He was really honest with a lot of things. And my favorite part of the interview is at some point, he just goes on a 30-second laughing spree because of a great question that Max asked. So it's good. It'll be coming up shortly. We're going to let this interview pretty much carry the episode. But we still need to do like our thing.
I mean, We'll do our Scarlet 7 afterwards to kind of like break it down, see what we talk about.
Wait, did you just commit us to doing something on the back end?
No, we're not. That was the joke. No, 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 we'll just have nothing on the back
end. I didn't understand.
Probably your sign off, and that'll be it. That's how we'll
end. All right, you got to add. I didn't end the interview that way.
Yeah, so
it's a discussion. It's a discussion. I don't like the word interview.
Okay, good call. Because that's what we do. We just kind of bullshit. Yeah. I think we like that.
We had a lot of fun. We covered a lot of ground. How many told in separate parts, obviously, probably the most serious story we've ever had on the podcast and maybe the funniest, most ridiculous thing anyone has ever said on the podcast. It's one of our better interviews. Like I have one thing he said in particular, I laughed at more than I think I've laughed at anything that anyone has ever said on this podcast. I'm overselling here, but something he said was so good. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot.
Do you want to like at least say about what it was that he was talking about without saying what he said?
It had to do with rap videos.
Oh right. Yeah. By the way, if you're listening to this podcast and you still have one of these Hamidi T-shirts from 2010, just tweet us your photo of your T-shirt.
Yeah, block party.
The block party shirts.
Yeah, the block party. Greatest thing that Adam ever did.
Our good buddy Danny Breslauer, I think, still has that shirt.
I still have mine.
From time to time. I think it's like Danny got like a size small back then too, and it still fits him right now. So
I mean, he's gone from what, a small to a medium?
Like, yeah, pretty much. That's
all those years in the gym, and he's still jacked now.
By the way, speaking,
Max, make that a poll question. Is he a medium?
Is Danny a medium?
No, just put, is he a medium?
I think you might as well tag Danny in it because that always gets us.
I want Danny to be like, what the hell are they doing?
No, come on. Let's grovel all to the people. Should, and get so some should views. It
be, does at Danny Breslauer wear a schmedium?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or has Danny Breslauer evolved from a small to a schmedium? Phrasing it. So that interview is coming up soon. We talked about the fact that apparently we're just always political. Did you guys see today that Rutgers is a liberal cesspool for canceling a large portion of their classes in the fall already?
Or making that a headline?
I don't know.
Oh, guys, wait.
That's what I want to talk today.
I'm going to break this in again because Adam texted us this directly after our last podcast taping. And I just want to make sure after all of our bluster, we weren't backtracking. We weren't too scared to talk about the topic. I just want everyone to know that the reason we didn't talk about the softball report last episode was only due to incompetence and bad memory for no other reason. So I just want to raise it now.
What is there to say?
There's nothing to say other than the fact that it would have been funny bringing it up, but it's even more funny.
I mean, what is there to say? The creepy softball husband tells you that, hey, I'm the creepy softball husband, and no one can be bothered to make a phone call to find out about it, despite six-figure salaries. So I don't really know what else to say.
But the big news, we're taping on the day where Rutgers announced that the majority of the fall semester is going to be online for most students. Some students, wink, wink, student athletes in particular, probably going to be on campus because as of right now, they're under the assumption that sports are going to be played. Probably won't be. But we're under the assumption right now that it would be. So they're, of course, going to get some priority, and they're going to be on campus. So that's why I was laughing at the fact that, you know, Rutgers put out a very, seemingly harmless statement in the fact, like, hey, here's our plan for the fall. And somehow, can either of you two help me in terms of how that is a political statement? I'm still having trouble figuring this out with most people.
Because it's just the flu. What do you mean? Like,
okay.
Adam, if they just open the economy back up,
how is that political?
If they open the economy back up, then it wouldn't be a political statement.
You're spending your time trying to figure out the meaning behind people saying stuff who are just completely full of shit. So, like, you're just wasting your time.
It's just
like,
really crazy to me.
It's a decoder ring for stupidity. I'm not.
It's not as easy for me to just kind of whitewash those people and like forget them.
Yeah, I mean,
like they're a huge portion of society.
What have we seen happen in sports recently? Right. What did we see happen in NASCAR? Just ignore the dumb loud people. Just ignore them.
Yeah, like, Max, you missed my good joke there.
I didn't hear it. Sorry.
You asked what has been going on in sports. I said Bubba Wallace lied.
Wow.
That was funny.
Wow. I mean, it's funny if you have context. I don't know. Do the people have context?
Yes, because it's coming from me. Of course it's funny.
Right, of course. but about the whole, like, Rutgers announcing, you know, mostly no in-person classes and having, you know, some things in person. I guess like lab work will be done in person. Who knows exactly what it's going to be? I would say like, I personally don't believe that the fall sports season is going to happen. And I don't think that Rutgers thinks that's going to happen. There's two things going on here. Number one, like Rutgers can't just come out and unilaterally say, we're not playing sports. Like the Big Ten has to do that, right? Like Rutgers isn't just going to say that. And so, you know, apparently, so we're recording this on Monday afternoon, July 6th. Apparently the Ivy League is announcing what they're planning on doing on Wednesday in 2 days. And kind of what we saw with the conference tournament stuff, once the Ivy League canceled their conference tournament, everything kind of fell in place after that. And I just have a feeling that after the Ivy League kind of announces what they're planning on doing, then, you know, getting upset about whatever the plans are now is kind of a waste of time. Like, let's see how this plays out, because I still don't believe that we're anywhere close to getting college sports back. So I don't know. Like, I have plenty of thoughts on the matter. I've given some of them before. It kind of gets me worked up, the idea of playing sports through a pandemic, and you're not having anyone on campus, and you're not, you know, you're compensating these players with, you know, what are you compensating them with? A dorm that they have to like stay in all the time. They have to wear masks,
the college experience
of wearing masks everywhere. And oh yeah, no one else is on campus, and you're taking classes online, like, and you're only let out to do football things. But again, like, that's assuming that there's going to be sports, and I just don't think that's going to happen. And then kind of going off of that, I've been thinking recently more about the idea of bringing the players back now. And in some ways, I kind of understand having them back for a little bit, even if you're not planning on having a season. Because, you know, what did you guys do? Like, I know these are athletes. I know they're not us, right? But what did you guys do when you were 18 to 22 years old and you were away from school, unstructured time? I mean, personally, I smoked a lot of weed and ate a lot of food. So I just understand the idea of getting these players on campus, seeing the kind of physical shape that they're in, kind of getting some sort of plan going forward. I kind of sold myself on the idea of them being on campus for a little bit, assuming we're going to have sports at some point in the future. Like, maybe not necessarily planning on having a season, but just getting them on campus to kind of keep them in some kind of shape. I don't know.
Well, we're a week away from the mandatory workout start.
I don't think that's going to happen, though. But I understand the idea of getting them back for a little bit, even if you're not planning on having a season.
I think mandatory workout, I'll say it now because we just don't know, but my guess is those workouts are going to happen.
I think so too.
Majority of schools. Like, I think that everybody's going under the assumption that, and we know that they're going to try and play, and we know why they're going to try and play. We've said it a million times here. We don't need to rehash it. I just thought that, I only brought it up because it was funny, because apparently Rutgers just being a little bit proactive and like saying, like, here's our plan for the fall. Like, you guys wanted a plan. Here's the plan. And now that's
it is.
We did want a plan. It's good to know the plan, so we can say this plan is stupid.
University saying what they're going to do.
But it is.
Breaking news. Breaking news. 10-year contract extension for Patrick Mahomes.
Wow, that's big. What are you going to be doing in 10 years? What am I going to be doing in 10 years?
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to be in our 40s.
Ugh. Wow. Don't tell people our age.
Doing this. Danny will still be a schmedium.
Maybe by then we'll be co-hosts of the Scarlet Spotlight podcast.
So Patrick Mahomes extension.
The only other thing
maybe we'll get the
up.
Answer.
It is cool that Rutgers is like Rutgers the first school outside of like California to announce like a real kind of plan? Like, there's not that many. I haven't heard of many schools really announcing their plan. And I think one of the things that has been bothering me about going forward is that they're leaving a lot of kids, like, forget sports for a minute. You're leaving a lot of college students just kind of hanging out there, not knowing what their futures are going to be like. And a lot of these schools are going on as if they're going to have in-person classes and their campuses are going to be open. But like in most places, I can't imagine that's actually going to be the case. So it is good for Rutgers to get this out there here now in early July, when, you know, a lot of schools have students coming on campus starting in early August. Rutgers is, Rutgers is one of the schools that starts later than most schools, right? Most schools are starting, you know, mid-August or so. Rutgers more in late August and early September. So it is cool. It is good that Rutgers is getting more out in front of this with a concrete plan, as opposed to other universities. So that part is cool.
Do you like Can you imagine like what it would have been like to go through your first semester of freshman year just living at home, and just how drastically different your college experience would have been?
It would have sucked. Nobody's like, I have a lot of sympathy for whatever, like everybody's going through their own things right now. Everybody's scared. There's a whole lot of unknowns. Like, you know, it's going to be weird. Like, we just don't know. We don't, like, again, it's, as Max has said, like a week from now, it could be totally different. And we could be like, okay, everything's going to happen, or everything needs to be shut down again. We just don't know. And I think that, like, it's good that Rutgers is being proactive. It's great that they have a plan in place. And, like, if things did get, better, Rutgers couldn't, like, figure out something else to, like, bring more kids on campus? Of course they could.
Well, I mean, like, things are in, like, relatively speaking, things are in kind of, like, a calm period for the virus in New Jersey as of this moment. But there's a stark
the United States that we have to deal with.
No, but I'm saying there's a stark danger in, even in New Jersey, bringing how many people are on campus now?
From, like, all across the country, and
or even 30,000 people, like 30,000 New Jerseyans to right. campus all at once, all of college age, who we've seen are not, like, the most rational acting people at the moment, let alone coming in from every other state.
Yeah. So here's my big question for the people that are coming back. When they get to Rutgers, are they going to be at the State University of New Jersey that is in Central Jersey or North Jersey?
Yeah, a bunch of suckers out there.
That's a segue.
What a bunch of suckers.
Why do people still fall for Max's nonsense? All right.
Can we take a vote, by the way? Can we take a podcast vote right now?
Can you actually put that as a Twitter poll?
I hear. Tell me what to say.
Bullshit.
So, for the people who don't follow us on Twitter, yesterday afternoon, I was sitting in the passenger seat of a car. I was a little bored. I was on my phone. I was like, what can I do right now? I was looking at a map or something. I was like, oh, I know what I can do. I can draw a random line through the center of New Jersey and say, above this line is North Jersey, below this line is South Jersey, post it on Twitter, and watch the Central Jersey zealots go crazy. I have pulled some sort of this trick, like, once every 3 or 4 months on Twitter, and people just forget or whatever, and they get so riled up every time. These Central Jersey, like, truthers or whatever, they get so mad anytime you suggest that Central Jersey doesn't exist. I don't care. I don't have an opinion on it. Though? I don't care.
I'm agnostic.
It's not something I care about. All I care about is causing chaos. And I did, and I had fun. So that's all I care about. And they fell for it again. And when I do it 3 or 4 months from now, they'll fall for it once again, because that is the internet. It's great.
I sense Max's gubernatorial campaign platform right now, just trolling New Jerseyans until enough are riled up to vote for him.
It's just really funny for the people that have to, like, that do like engaging with us on what stuff, like, Max decides to just play with people for the sake of playing with people. And it's so obvious to us, but it's not obvious to them.
And it's not even, like, on a serious topic, right? Like, it was funny how Mike distanced himself from the map. Some of the stuff I've tweeted about racial issues and college sports and the pandemic stuff, and some of the sort of extreme stuff that stuff is real, by the way. That's not like that's real stuff that I believe. Mike hasn't distanced himself from that because I think he agrees with it, but he made sure to distance himself from the Central Jersey does not exist implication of the map that I made.
This is why Mike would make a fairly decent politician in our current climate.
When me and Raj start our own legal outfit, I can't actually be a lawyer. I think the state of New Jersey would bar me from that. But when we start our legal outfit, this is what we'll litigate. I'm just saying, I don't know if New Jersey, I don't know if Central Jersey exists, but I also don't know that it doesn't exist. I honestly had never heard of Central Jersey until I got to Rutgers, when all these people were like, we're from Central Jersey, and I'm like, what the hell does that mean?
I'm gonna.
By the way, so far,
who cares, I mean, Central Jersey exists.
It's not a big sample right now, but 80% believe that our podcast is a political statement. Like, the podcast itself is a political statement. Like, again, how stupid are people? Yes. The podcast that brought you We Can Get Chiano Maybe is just doing this for political purposes.
All right, I want to call out the Scarlet spotlight, the Red Spotlight, aka Scarlet Pravda podcast, for talking to Greg Schiano and not asking him whether he had heard "We Can Get Schiano Maybe."
Yeah, that was absurd.
That was offensive to me.
It did apparently come up in their production meeting, though.
I don't care. Ask the damn question. Ask the damn question.
I'm going to send a email to the athletic director, and I better hear back from John Newman.
I don't even care that they didn't talk to Schiano about the athletic director starting a fundraising campaign to get him hired. Fine, whatever. But ask the question about the song. That's all people care about.
Was this, they should have asked, Greg, was this the first campaign that you know of where a school's athletic director crowdsourced its funding to hire you? Like, that would have been a proper question at that point. But anyways.
It actually would have been funny if someone started like a GoFundMe to hire Greg Schiano.
I mean, that's basically what they did.
I know, but I wanted, like, you know, it being passed around and like message boards, like, here's the GoFundMe. Contribute now to hire Greg Schiano as your next head coach.
Oh, man. All right. Well, just so everybody knows,
oh, it's a child. It's a baby.
Interview. Max has a child on the screen.
I won't say whose baby, but there's a baby there.
Well, Mike just said.
I said it.
He's been good this whole, he's been here this whole time. He's been watching some Sesame Street. I got a little restless though.
You're shirtless today.
I am for
it. I'm just saying, I kind of like, you know, the free flowing style of today's the vibe.
Good. Can we be honest with our listeners? And I just want to be honest with you. We really just needed to get like 15 to 20 minutes of recorded recorded podcast so we can move on and put out the Hominy interview.
Yeah,
like,
we actually
really all just us filibustering.
Well, at least Mike's wearing a shirt, but so me, Mike, and a couple other friends were doing this thing where we did like sports trivia once a week via Zoom. And this one time, we talked about this in the podcast. It actually wasn't during trivia. It was, we were watching the draft via Zoom, the NFL draft, and Mike was shirtless and eating like corn on the cob. That was disgusting. But I think we actually already talked about this on the podcast.
That's an odd
thing. Was the corn on the cob disgusting, or was the shirtlessness?
I think shirtless corn on the cob is gross.
Mike, if you or Max, if you guys had to do a food eating contest this past weekend, we saw what's his name down 75 wieners.
This is where the blank sound would be. We don't have that capability.
The Nathan's hot dog eating. Joey Chestnut. That's a guy I was thinking
Joseph
about.
Chestnut.
If you had to, what's one food item that you could just demolish and be part of a food eating contest? Mm.
That's a tough one.
That is a tough one. Mm.
You know what? I don't know if this counts. I guess most people could do this because it's like, it's frozen ice with like sugar, but like those like ice pops that you buy in the box that just come as like as liquid in like a plastic tube.
Oh, the old
that's like drinking water.
But I could eat those. I think
sugar water.
I could probably go through a whole box of those in like 30 minutes.
That's not even impressive.
Like 100 of those in like 30 minutes, and that's impressive.
No, that's not impressive. I mean, I can eat a lot of like. I won a pizza eating contest at Rutgers.
Oh, you did?
I did. I ate 12 slices in 15 minutes.
That's impressive.
Kind of disappointing, I think. I think I could have done more. I couldn't do the Paulie's Pizza Challenge. It was just really a big setback for me. I think I could have eaten like 30-plus wings in one sitting at one point.
One of the guys who was in the hot dog eating contest, I didn't even know this was a thing. He held the record for most matzo balls eaten, as How well many? As Hummantaschen.
What?
Oh, I. Wait, was that Moses?
How many How big are the Hummantaschen?
That's kind of what I wanted to know, is what kind of Hummantaschen we're dealing with here. Is it fresh out of the oven Hummantaschen? What's the filling in the Hummantaschen?
So, apricot. The only reason I know who this guy is, so Don Lerman. His name is Don Moses Lerman. So I used to, when I lived in South Jersey as a kid, they had this thing called the Wing Bowl.
I remember that.
Man, Philly.
And he was one of the competitors. He is like the world's, he's like, one's all like the matzo ball eating contest. I got to see if I can find like matzo ball eating contest. 7 quarter-pound sticks of salted butter in 5 minutes. That's a world record.
Yikes.
2.76 pounds of pork and chicken bologna in 6 minutes. 6 pounds of baked beans in 1 minute and 48 seconds. This guy, he's part of the tribe. He's one of us. So, you know.
All right. Well,
there we go. What did you guys do for July 4th, by the way? How did you celebrate it?
We're going to go over our personal stuff.
Yeah.
We had a barbecue.
Yeah, I was at a barbecue.
At a, at, you know, distance and all that stuff. But I made had a barbecue.
We're okay. Here, let's go with the big topic. Was anybody really perturbed by all the fireworks going on July 4th?
I didn't hear that many, really.
It's a big hot topic of debate now. It's just
fireworks are a political statement.
Yeah, everything, just like the podcast. Apparently, it's just pretty crazy. So I don't know. That's all. That's all I got. I think we should.
What else is a political statement?
The Hamidanjai interview is also a political. Actually, no. You know what? Disclaimer: we didn't go over anything political or anything really questionable with Hamidanjai that you could take it as a political statement. So let's just get to the interview with Hamidanjai. What do we say?
I guess we didn't play overrated, underrated, but yeah, okay.
This interview is properly rated. It's awesome. Enjoy. All right. Really excited for this interview here with Hamidanjai, former Scarlet Knight basketball player, and probably one of the most beloved Scarlet Knights to most fans out there. So, H, first off, for those that kind of haven't been maybe following what you're up to most recently, where are you currently? What's been going on with basketball as well as the pandemic?
Well, first, hi, thanks for having me, and I'm really, that was a great intro, I love it. But yeah, I'm in France right now. I played this season in the north of France in Gravelines, and I kind of been stuck here the whole time with the quarantine and everything. It was a great season. This is my first season in France, so I was trying out. I like trying out new places, and also I came first year, well, Corona ain't really helped me out so much, but I got stuck here, and lucky for me, I got family out here, so I'm good.
So for you, it's interesting. You have been everywhere in terms of professional basketball from the time you were drafted out of Rutgers to, I mean, I can't even count the different countries now that you've played in. So for you now, looking back at kind of where you're at, is there a place right now that you say has been kind of the most fun to play at since your days at Rutgers? Like what have you most enjoyed? Cause I know you've been in the Philippines, Israel for a little bit, Italy, France. I mean, you've been everywhere.
The list. Yeah. I look back at it now. I think now that I'm at the time where I can kind of settle and for a while I didn't realize because I played about 11 months out of the year every year. And I refused to take a break and I kept going from team to team. So I can't really pick a place. I love the Philippines, honestly, as a country. Ever since Rutgers, that was really one of my favorites. Israel was another one that I really loved being at, the environment and everything. But playing-wise, it's different. You can't really say which is your favorite country because every aspect is kind of different in either the living conditions or this playing style and all of those things, and you got to kind of calibrate and figure out which one I like. I enjoyed playing in Spain the most. It was probably the hardest after the NBA for sure, and that one I enjoyed a lot. So Spain, I had a great time in Italy. So this is why you see, I just named every single place and everywhere I go, it feels the same. Like, I feel like I take records everywhere with me and everywhere I go somewhere, I'm like, yeah, this is my new favorite. And I'm like, no, there's another place. All right, cool. So I still enjoy it so much that I can't tell you what was a bad thing in my experience so far.
Yeah. We should ask you which place you hated the most. You just gone negative.
Oh. Yeah, there is one, actually. Yeah, there is one. There is definitely one. I think that was Lebanon. That was one place that I was just like, I'm never, ever, ever not doing this again to myself. That one, I was like, yeah. And a lot of my friends had a great experience there. That's why it kind of messed me up. And I was like, how come I had the bad experience out of everybody? But it was that one. I was like, no, I'm not doing that one again, for sure.
Have you been to Rutgers lately? When was the last time you went back?
See, last time I've driven through Rutgers, because when I come back in the summer, sometimes for 3 weeks about when I'm back in the States. And there is usually no one in the school. Then I just get to come by, say hi to the teachers or the ones that I know that are there real quick. Or the coaching if they are there. But last time, I think it was about 3 years ago in the summertime that I drove past and got lost inside of Rutgers. And I didn't understand what was going on. The rack was there, but whatever was around wasn't the rack, so it was just like I was very confused of what was going on, and I was mad actually that no one told me everything that was really happening. So I got in touch with Randy Larson, who was my academic advisor at the time, and we talked about it. And I was like, "This is amazing! I can't believe like this wasn't even a thought when we were here. It's so beautiful now. I feel like it's a brand new. They just took buildings and just put them right in the middle of everything that was open out there. So it's really beautiful, and I can't wait to be able to actually come back. Because I tell every year since I left, I got the proof where every year I tell Randy, I'm coming to a game, and I'm never there for the games. so that right there is really, really hurts, and I really want to have the time to get back and just spend time there again, get the memories and all that.
H, I mean, you know, it's funny. You mentioned what's changed at Rutgers, and the big thing this past year is the fact that, I mean, they were going to go to the NCAA tournament, and I'm curious if you followed that team closely at all, and kind of if you had any emotional reaction to the season that they were having and kind of having it being taken away. It kind of feels like that's typical Rutgers. It's what we experience all the time. So what were your thoughts on what you were seeing unfold this past year?
Well, see, how can I put this? Just like you asked the question the right way, because yeah, it is kind of a damn, we were right there. And once again, there is nothing you can do about it, but we had a chance to do something really that been waiting for a very long time. And unfortunately, the conditions were not ours to pick from or decide if we can keep the season going or whatever that is. So it's unfortunate with everything going on, but it does give you hope that it is possible to see these kids actually accomplish something for Rutgers that everyone sees is possible. Every generation that I've watched since I've left have proven to kind of be a little better than we were at our time. And I hate to say it, but even when I came the last time I got to see the guys, and I got to see them play and work out and everything. I was kind of very proud to see the level of discipline and everything going on. And to admit that they were actually better than we were at our time, even though we had our showtime and all those things, but they were better and it looked better. It's a cleaner basketball and very beautiful to watch at this right now. I enjoy seeing the news. I can't get to see all the team whenever they play, but I enjoy seeing the victories and everyone celebrating and everything. And that right there is something that even if I'm not there, I mean, just like you guys, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if you are there physically or not, you still feel the same way when they make it. So that part right there, I enjoy.
How many? Sorry, Mike, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it took, you know, if it had happened this year, 29 years since the last time, maybe it'll be 30 if there's a college basketball season. While you were there, like, did you ever feel like you guys were close to having a team that might compete for a tournament spot? Like, what was the level of realism and optimism while you were at the school?
You remember our records, right?
I do. I do. That's why I'm asking if you ever felt like maybe coming into a year, like maybe this is the year where we get on the brink, or did you ever feel like it was never that close?
No. Let's be honest here. The happiest I've been is when I heard that everyone was allowed to get to the Big East tournament and that we were going to be able to actually play in those things. That was the biggest moment of my career. Okay, I was so happy that I couldn't really you can't tell on the video, you know, like, but this is it. We go into the tournament. No matter what, we're going to make it, not just get all the way to the door and then stumble again or fight for that last win. No, we're actually going to make it, whether we deserve it or not. Shoot, that was a trip for me. So, no, I can't tell you that in our time we were like, we about to make it to the tournament. No, that wasn't – I don't remember. If anyone says it, I wasn't part of that conversation because I was pretty real about what I was trying to do. I was trying to win as many games as I possibly could. But I can't tell you that I was trying to get to the tournament and beat. Nah, I knew what we were and what it was going to take to get to that next level. Now, with Mike Rosario, Echenique, and all of those guys in the beginning of that last season, my senior year, I did get hope that we were going to accomplish something real great. We had the tools for that, and I believed it, honestly. I believed that everything was going to happen the right way. Now, how things broke down in the middle of the season and the moves and people left and the unhappiness and all those things that was going on, and I was trying to focus on really finishing out my career the right way at Rutgers and all those things, I kind of had to get real with myself at a certain point and be like, all right, we might not make it to the NCAA, but we can make a mark in the Big East tournament. And that I thought we were going to make a run that no one expected. You know, the guy that no one expected to do anything, that I always, my storyline of just trying to accomplish things, I believe that it was possible to actually do that in the Big East tournament that year. And to lose the first actual game was not so cool for me to finish my career on that note. I did get the block record on it, but it was still unfortunate that we lost that game that I really was looking forward to.
Now, Hamidi, now obviously you improved so much over your career. Yeah, Rutgers all-time leader in block shots, Big East Defensive Player of the Year. But I want to go back to your freshman year real quick, because there's something I distinctly remember about your freshman year. There were several occasions where you would trip and your shorts fell down. And I need to know what was going on there. Were you not tying them tight enough? Were they too big? Like, what was going on with your shorts falling down? Because it happened two or three times throughout the season.
Oh wow. Wow, that was a good, that wasn't expecting that question at all. That was good. Okay. All right, so you saw those shorts, okay? You remember how big those uniforms were for the skinny African that I was my freshman year, okay? I felt like I was wearing a 6XL t-shirt and a 6XL short that was supposed to tuck in those shorts that were so heavy. And then you forget that my freshman year was mainly diving on the floor and doing things that no one expected a 7-footer to do, which at the time, I didn't even know how to double tie my shorts or anything like that. So I'm not calculating in the moment that, hey, your string might just pop at some point, you know? And I wasn't thinking of those things. I expected my jersey to be solid enough since it was so heavy. Now, when it happened, I'm not going to lie, I still remember having a highlight of it at the end. They made a full highlight of my season. And at the end of it, you got my shorts falling down and me looking at the camera backwards like, oh snap. That was really, really, I can't believe you remember those things.
Yeah, we remember a lot of weird stuff. You know, and Max brought up something too early on. You know, in my freshman year, I believe it was. So we went to the game at Seton Hall where you guys won on the buzzer beater, JR's buzzer beater. And I believe that was the first game or that game after a couple of my buddies finally decided, all right, it's time to go. And like, we finally have a couple of fun guys to root for. I know you guys had struggled and was like, how are we going to get people excited? That's where we came up with the idea to get the Senegalese flag and start bringing it to every game. Did you kind of like just embrace that? I feel like you were just the guy that loved people and loved the fans. I mean, did you just kind of embrace that kind of personality from that point on?
That was it. I'm not gonna actually even, it was a turning point in my actual whole career. In my career, that moment right there is where I realized the connections I could have with the crowd instead of just my team. I used to always be on team focus and everything, but the moment this was the first time in my career I've seen my country flag in the stands. There is nothing I can give but give my 100% into this world that actually accepted me, because I don't think we don't really speak on the fact that I was in America by myself for a lot of time. I came alone and left my family. By the time I got to work, I did 2 years in America, learned English, and got to Rutgers, and my career was already going. So to feel home, you know, when people used to go to summer home, summers and home and vacations or Christmas and things like that, my home was Rutgers. It was, I was at, on the court at the rack. Like, I was enjoying that time, or having Randy invite me to eat or something like that. That was my family. So when that turned to become everyone around, I felt that one picture of my flag that represented me, basically, and how everyone knew what I was, that moment was, okay, I can connect. And that energy is what I still play with. Feeling that those emotions where there is nothing, a player that feels home somewhere, no matter what it is going to give 100%, no matter what they tell them, however the things goes, I will wake up every single day trying to give. And that was a turning point for me, because I realized that I can feel home anywhere. You know, I can be home. I can be accepted. It was a struggle to get to a point where I actually felt accepted for who I was, the African guy, the crazy guy who did this. You know, everyone seen me on the court going crazy. Oh, this guy is a little. But at the moment where people are like, it's okay to be crazy. We like you for being crazy, actually. Do your crazy thing or whatever. Be you, and just we enjoy. It's cool. Let's have fun with it. And that acceptance right there was a turning point for me, where I was like, I don't have to change my game and what I do. Everyone knows I'm not the biggest scorer in the game. I'm not, but I'm the guy that's going to do everything for the team. And that was kind of how I interpreted it, or I felt it when I saw the flag. Was like, all right, we got you guys and everything, and it helped me a lot. So yeah, I don't know if I told you guys before. I know I probably said it in the messages or whatever, but I couldn't thank you guys enough for that moment. And every time I see my school highlight, it's still the first thing that pops up, and it's just like I still see the flag all the way to my senior night, which is probably the best moment of my entire career till now. Still, yeah.
that's awesome. I mean, Hamidi, I don't know if like a lot of people, you talked about how it took you a while to get comfortable and to feel at home. I remember you went through some stuff in high school just to get to Rutgers. I mean, are you able to, could you recount how you left your first prep school in Florida to get to Stone Ridge? Because if I remember right, that was like that's a wild story and kind of emblematic of the path you took.
I was telling the story to my niece yesterday, actually, the exact story of that, where this was my second year in America, and it felt, I'm going to try to make it not so long in details and everything, but it was an opportunity. Yeah. It was an opportunity for me to reunite with not only the guy who found me, started my basketball career in Senegal, but the friends that I had in Senegal who were coming to America, and I already had spent 1 year in America. So for me, I wanted to be that guy that came with them, and we were together anyways, and helped them for my last year of high school before I get to college. So we found a school in Florida called Florida Prep, and we all went there. I was in Jersey first, and I went to Florida Prep, where everything went great. We had an amazing summer where we had great talents from Africa come that my coach brought and everything, and we were winning tournaments, and everything was great. So at a certain point, the power trip started happening, because the guy who was supposed to be the principal of the school ended up trying to blackball my coach and not bring him back to the thing, so he could basically take advantage of the players, and didn't send him the paperwork necessary for him to come back. So now we're stuck in Florida with this kind of dictator principal guy who really was mistreating us. They were treating us really like things really bad. For Africans, black guys, or whatever, that was really at the time not normal. Even for me, who was only in America for a year, I knew that wasn't right. So as we discussed it with my coach, Babacar, who found us, we decided that we couldn't deal with it anymore. And the tension started rising. We were not eating anymore for weeks. We had to resort to basic things to find food, like fishing ourselves and things like that, and still had to go to practice and school every single day. They were threatening us with things like, yeah, if you don't practice hard after not eating all day or whatever, if you don't practice hard, we're not going to give you a double cheeseburger from McDonald's. This is 8 p.m. We have spent all day without eating, and you're threatening us to practice, then get a double cheeseburger from McDonald's, like it was a reward or whatever. So that went up to an explosion, and we ended up just deciding, we decided to run away. So we kind of packed our stuff, didn't tell anyone, used the van and ran away and no one could find us. A bunch of seven-footers just disappeared. African seven-footers just disappeared in a while. They were looking for us and everything. But like I said, by the grace of God, things just happened that way, that Babacar ended up meeting someone who wanted to start something new and something good for kids and all. And his son was actually playing basketball, and he helped him real quick set up a school, Stone Ridge Prep. I believe he bought the school. I'm not going to be exact on the terms, but I think he bought the school in Stone Ridge in California, flew us out to California, started a whole schedule for us, but we couldn't play in California and had to basically fly to the East Coast every weekend to play games against prep school. And each and every one of us basically ended up with a D1 scholarship, even though that whole story happened. So to us, it's just like, it kind of taught us that no matter what, there is a way out of things, and you just gotta stay focused and keep doing the right thing all the way through. So the story was crazy, but that was one of so many things that happened to us. I try to make it fast. There's a lot of details that I just kind of, but yeah, it was a rough time in my second year in America for sure.
When you got to America, was there any kind of culture shock? I mean, anything that you were like, oh man, like, or food wise, like, oh man, we can't get this back home, or anything that you saw was like, I can't believe this is like that here. Like, cause you hear a lot of people, they get to the US and they just see stuff that they can't believe, you know, when they get here.
Well, we don't have McDonald's still in Senegal. So that was something I wanted to experience for sure. That was my thing. Before coming to America, I wanted to see what McDonald's was about, because everyone talked about it, but I never seen one or had one. So culture shock, I would say that I was, but not for the reasons you think. I was a big fan of 50 Cent and Eminem when I was in Senegal, and I basically knew all of their lyrics without knowing what he meant. And to me, America was everything I've seen in 50 Cent videos. So when I landed in Burlington, New Jersey, and there was no pimping cars and no beach and no, it was absolutely, there was snow and dirty roads, and it was not the America that I actually thought I was gonna be. My first time in Miami was where I was like, this is America. I just got to America, okay? But my first year, I didn't believe. I thought I was in some lost island somewhere. They were like, this can't be America. Then I landed in JFK, so I was like, it had to be America, but this is not what 50 said. He was like, you can find me in the club, bottle from the bub with them. I don't know what he means, but I know that's not what it looked like to me. So yeah, that was a culture shock for me.
How many just landing in America and expecting to be in the middle of a 50 Cent video is one of the funniest things anyone's ever said on this podcast. Like that is incredible. That's so good.
How many? I think
the landing is not the best part, because I landed with a suitcase with only one pair of jeans, and really it was nothing in it, and beside like a couple things that my mom made me really. So landing in America, in my first hour, I had a flat tire, and I had to fix that tire. And that was one of the most revealing moments, because in that first hour in America, I was like, all right, I'm here to work. I'm not really here to play around with nobody. I'm really here. God is telling me I got to get to work, basically. That's what the message was. So, yeah, that was amazing for me.
Hamidi, I think my family, when we immigrated to the U.S., we also landed at JFK. I think that's just mean to make immigrants come to JFK as your first view of America. Like, that's just playing a cruel trick on all of us.
You are absolutely right. Absolutely. JFK especially. You could even, I don't know. I like Newark. Yeah, I would probably.
Newark's better now, I guess.
Yeah. It's better now. But JFK was just not that America, this is America feeling that I was expecting on my 8-hour flight from Senegal, first time leaving my parents and all. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get to 50 Cent. I still ain't meet 50 Cent, by the way.
I wish we could help you out with that one, but we don't have any connections on this. The only connection I have, actually, is I texted the buddy who I thought I was like, who came up with the idea to get the flag one time. And I know this is audio, but I'm going to hold it up. He actually just sent me the picture. He still has the flag. So it's still being kept in pristine shape. It survived the days at the rack, and he still got it in his house. So it's survived.
That was the first time.
We got to combine it. We got to combine it with my jersey.
I like that idea. There was a talk for a long time when you kept going between like the Kings and the Wizards. I was like, at some point I need to get an NJ jersey. And like, I just don't know at some point which team it's going to happen for. So yeah, we'll just go back to the Rutgers one and be good with that and stick with that one. Yeah. I did have a question for you. I mean, you were such a fun guy, and there were a lot of fun moments. I know you talked about your senior night, but is there anything else that stands out to you, like a favorite game or memory that kind of maybe either goes under the radar or just something that you hold close in your mind for any reason?
I would believe it was probably all of my battles. The games that really marked me and that really meant more than anything to me were any games against Notre Dame, which had Herring Gordy, who was the best scorer in the Big East. Any games against the one game we won against Pittsburgh.
When Mike Coburn kept hit every shot. Week.
And then if I remember correctly, didn't you pretty much destroy Greg Monroe for a little bit in one game when you guys beat them, I believe, at home too?
Yep, that was it, yeah. But see, the thing for me was also that realized it late in my career was that I was so focused on, you know how I started basketball late, I was so focused on trying to better myself that I never really paid attention to the guys against who I was playing. So I didn't know the hype. I never really followed who was who. And just like Greg Monroe and all of those guys, besides the Beat, let's say, and Hibbert, who was like, those were personal rivalries that I don't even think they knew I had in my head at the time. It was just like, yeah, there's blood gonna fall, that's for sure. And those things were things I really enjoyed. And those games, I still remember them. Like, I'll see one highlight, and I remember this day. I really remember that. And but the games against Notre Dame were something that really, to me, were big because of just knowing that Herring Gordy was the best scorer there was in the Big East, and no one could stop him. And whenever he came to Rutgers, it was like, shut down moment. This is not the day. You're going to find something else. And that right there was my joy. Really, that was probably my favorite moments at Rutgers, were shutting that down.
So yeah. Was it Luke Herring Gordy? I was going to ask, like, was there one guy who, like, going into the game, like, I'm going to have a battle tonight. This is, like, the guy I'm most pumped to face, the toughest matchup, or, you know, the guy that you got really pumped to go against. Was it Luke Herring Gordy, or was it somebody else?
Herring Gordy and Thabit were the two guys there. But Thabit left and got to the league, and the hype wasn't there anymore. And it wasn't really much hype because he just stood under the paint and blocked every single thing. I didn't know. I knew what they were saying, but I didn't know how he was doing it. I'm like, how is he getting so many blocks? And that's not possible. And then I come to the game, and I'm looking at him, I'm like, this is not right. Like, but it didn't stop me from going at each other in that respect that I had for just where we came from and those things, and knowing that we were trying to make a name for ourselves and all those things. I love those battles that we had. Aaron Gordy was I don't even think he knew that I had it for him, honestly. It was just, he made me think, obviously, because I play defense and I don't like no one being the best scorer at anything. And I'm just like, no, I'm not going to accept that. And he was close enough to be a center that I was like, all right, this is my target for this year. No matter what happens, when you come here, it's going to be me and you, and this is not going to happen. And that gave me really some fire. So, yeah.
What about Herb Pope and Seton Hall? Did you get up for those games?
He's just stonewalled.
One Mississippi, two Mississippi.
That was I've never seen for a guy so controlled. And we all remember your senior night, man.
Whoo! Oh, wow. Yeah, that was that wasn't basketball, really. Those games for that name was just not for basketball. It was anything other than basketball. I never cared about the result of the game, honestly. It was really just what I was going to do to this guy once he would touch me. And I could, it was really, I can't, just today, it's 10 years later. Okay, do you realize this? 10 years later, I still feel the same way about it. And it all started at Seton Hall, and I still remember everything that happened that day. We were playing the game, and he just reached beneath my shorts and just had to do it. And I was just like, oh, no, this is not going to go. And the referee was standing there. So he did it the first time. The referee saw it, and I got a foul because I hit him. Second time, he did it again. The referee saw it and was like, you guys calm down. The third time we kind of tussled, and in my head I lost it and basically got ejected out of the game. And I was just like, that from that day on, that was it. And he never, every single game we saw each other, he did things. He was that one player that was just willing to go beyond and anything to frustrate me. And it didn't take much. I was ready to do anything. I did that. There was like the name. And that night, in my senior night, the fact that my parents were in the crowd was really what kind of contained me not to lose it how I wanted to. And I knew it was also that moment was way too important for me to ruin it for just one whatever.
I think long term you got the W over Herb Pope. You win out.
By a long shot, okay. But it's cool. I don't know what he became or even if he kept playing or anything. But I remember every time I tell the story or I hear the name, I'm like, this guy again.
Did coaches have to kind of – because those rivalries, I think, remember, especially those years, got a little bit heated than, like, the way it is now even. Did coaches have to tell you to calm down? Did they try to tell you to, like, keep your cool a little bit? Because there was such a frenzy in the crowd, on the court. I mean, Seton Hall, if I remember, I had a few guys that are always trying to start shit. I don't know if they had to, like, try to calm everyone down before the game.
Not everyone down. No, everyone doesn't have the same character on the court. Most, you know, the goal is usually to just trying to win the game, and that's the victory everyone is trying to win. But when you have a hothead like me, who is not taking no disrespect of anything from my team, my teammate, or anyone, I'm kind of like the guy who want to protect every single guy that's on the court. So if I see you do something illegal, whatever, there's no way to contain me. So for me, I believe they were doing, like, Coach Carr and those guys were really kind of coming to talk to me before, like, breathe a little bit. Even I remember Freddie coming to me one day and telling me that I had too much nervous energy before the game and that he was going to let me go the first minute and then he was going to bring me back out real quick because he knew how I was going to be anyway. So sometimes you have to do it for guys. There are players who just, I let the emotions at the time, I didn't know really how to control everything I felt. And like, you know, I take my energy from the crowd too. So once I see everything going on, it's, it builds up and I'm ready to just do anything. I will fight on the court, off the court, and everything from there.
What was with those teams you had mentioned kind of towards the end of your career, especially the last one? You guys, that was the one year you got, you won 15 games, the most that you had while at Rutgers. And some interesting names you mentioned, Echenique, Rosario. I'm curious, with everything that happened between Fred and was it difficult with the guys on that team to gel? Was Mike any bit of a problem with you being an elder guy on the team and trying to take leadership and everybody expecting him to kind of get the team to the next level? Was that where things kind of went wrong at all in your view, or what was it like playing on that team your last year?
I think I've said it in the beginning of that last year, and it was unfortunate. We lacked a little bit of discipline. We needed that strong figure on top who said, okay, you get this, you do this, and you do this. This is my opinion 10 years later. I'm not really sure if it was exactly what happened, but from just thinking about it, what I can remember is most people came back to me all the time and were frustrated with the distribution of the ball and Mike taking all the shots and everything. And though we knew Coach wanted him to take the shots, you understand? But again, we didn't calculate. We wanted him to get us somewhere, not thinking that the kid was really a kid at the time, okay? And you just gave him a green light to shoot the ball, so he doesn't know how to really do certain things or whatever. And it was our job as elder teammate or whatever that was to kind of build something around Mike. And that was something I didn't really know how to do by myself. And not also to forget that I was also put back in the beginning of that season, where I was coming off the bench now and playing even less minute than my entire career. I was playing, I think, seven or 10 minutes a game, or even sometimes five in the beginning of that season. And so what I had to say was things that I was doing personally. Like, I would approach Mike, I would approach Echenique, I would approach all the players individually or whatever, as the elder on the team. And even for Coach Hill himself, we would have discussions on what to do if disciplinary issues and things like that. I had some kind of talks with him when it was kind of necessary, because, you know, as when you have a kind of a star who just comes on the team, sometimes the rules are not the same, and it's okay. That's basketball. But for everyone else, you kind of want to be treated the same in college, no matter what your name is. So those things, we didn't really have time to get those things together in that 1 year. You understand? And that kind of slowed us down. And then the unhappiness didn't help. The injury, I think, of Greg Echenique that led him to leave the school did something to us at the same time, and now the dynamics are changing. So I don't think I ever figured out what the problem was, and I can't say it was the coach. I can't say, because I put it on myself as the only senior on that team that didn't get to get the team together and win those games that really meant for me. That's how I took it, basically. I did afterwards or whatever, before I even got drafted, I had to sit back and be like, okay, I tried, but I'm not that captain that was, or leader that was going to be, you do this or no. I'd like to just discuss things and we find a way, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't have any backup help, enough help or whatever for that season. And it wasn't, I can't say it's my fault either, because I'm not the only player on the team. We are together on the things or whatever, but for just to not put blame on anything, because I can't tell you what happened with Freddie. I don't really know. I know what I did and I know what I could have done better. And I've learned to do better as time went along and everything. I wish that I grew a little faster the role and everything. But I can't really say it was whose fault or whatever that was. It was just a unity thing that wasn't there. It was something that was missing We had a bigger unit the first 3 years with the crew, JR, Farmer, and Griffin, and all those guys. Even in my freshman year with Adrian Hill and those guys, you know, who actually wanted to teach, and I've learned from them in some way. So when it came time for me to be the lone senior of that year, I kind of felt like, shoot, I don't know how to relay my message to everyone else. So I just took the blame and ran with it and didn't really look back.
Amini, I'm looking at your career stats at Rutgers here, and I'm seeing 2 3-pointers taken, both missed. I need to ask, number one, do you remember taking either of those threes? And number two, did either of them almost go in? Maybe they were half-court heaves or something, but I'm seeing 2 attempted threes in your Rutgers career.
My face just now is telling you that I didn't – I thought of my first three-pointer I ever took was this past summer. Who I never knew I took a three-pointer. That right there, I have never, ever known. I ever took a three-pointer.
It's in the stats.
You got to find video.
I have to find this now because I took my first three-pointer this past summer, and I made it, obviously, I can't talk about it. But, I don't think I ever took a three-pointer voluntarily in the game. No, that just wasn't my thing. I knew that I know my job, and it wasn't that.
Yeah, coming off of that,
I know how to do it.
The international game's been a little bit ahead of the U.S. and the NBA as far as, you know, big men playing on the outside. We've seen in the NBA in recent years big men going outside and taking more outside shots, taking more threes. What do you make of the evolution of basketball? And, like, how, if at all, have you amended your game in kind of a more open style? Obviously, again, for people who don't know, international basketball rules are a little bit different, and it's a bit more open than the NBA has been, but recently we've seen it even in the NBA, a wide open game. Again, how have you kind of amended your game, if at all?
Well, definitely had to learn to shoot. That was to make it to be able to last. Now you kind of be able to shoot, even though I'm not required anywhere because my job is still the same from Rutgers. People don't really, when they bring me in, it's not to shoot the ball. It's mainly to make sure no one is scoring. So that is my main job. But to be able to keep my career going, I had to learn to actually shoot and score from different places and all those things and be a little more active, not just the back-to-the-basket game anymore that you rarely see. Had to find ways to make myself in the new game now. So it's a lot more active and just running and those things. It's not it changes the game, especially in Europe where the ball is mainly moving and shooting and those things. So you just got to adjust with the times and realize that at a certain point it's probably going to come back, the big men's and posting up and all those things, maybe with the bodies of the players, but it makes it a little bit fun because at the same time, us growing up in our generation, we were told not to dribble, not to shoot, not to do all of those things. And you're like, yeah, you're the big man. I remember when I first started, they were like, yo, you just got to be in the post. Don't even be at the end. They were like, yo, you get the post and pass it back. And your job is to do this. So we focus on that. But now that we get to do, everyone wants to be a point guard. No matter what your size is, you want to be a point guard in some way because you kind of get to do everything in the game. So the evolutions of the KDs and the tall players and all that are coming in shooting and driving and doing new things, it helps the game. But you just everyone has to grow with it.
Hamini, what was it like for you on draft night?
Draft night was pretty interesting for me. I've had 14 workouts before the draft. I had to do 14 workouts before the draft and still was unsure that it was going to happen. Yeah, my agent, Keith Glass at the time, was telling me that there was a good possibility of it happening. And I was confident he could get it done, but I had to go through every workout because obviously our games were not all televised. You know our record. We lost in the first game of the Big East. Though I was the Big East Defensive Player of the Year, I wasn't really known as a player everywhere else. Like every guy that wanted to get drafted. So I had to be seen. Teams didn't know who I was. I wasn't invited to, the combine either. But fortunately, I got to Portsmouth. And that's where I was seen, played a couple of games there. My agent worked out the workouts with all the teams and set a schedule for me. I was working out in Jersey and still going to all my workouts and all. So what ended up happening is draft night came, and I was actually at a friend's house real close to who was where I was actually staying at the time. And I remember I brought Coach Carr was there from Rutgers and everything. There was already a lot of drama going on with the Coach Hill situation and all those things. So I wasn't sure what to do with that. And it was in North Jersey. So I invited people from Rutgers, the certain managers, some friends of mine, and we just stayed and basically watched the draft that day. I expected to get drafted about second round, mid second round or something, but never really. I've never watched the full draft. I've never seen how those things work. So I didn't know that you basically can stay there all the way till 1 o'clock in the morning watching the draft. And I was there suited and booted, waited on my name to be called or not called. So it's funny that I told the story on Heron Goldie, who went before me, way before me. And I don't remember what number he got drafted. I think it was what was
Harry 52. Goldie? He went to the Celtics.
Yes,
before you, yeah.
Yep. And at that moment, that's the moment of the draft that I can really recall where I started really getting focused. Because first I thought I had a great impression on the Celtics or whatever, or someone had told me that. And when his name went through and I was like, okay, Heron Goldie got picked. Well, maybe I'm not going to get drafted, you know. They do like scores, and, you know, the thought process start going through. So I can't tell you that from 52 to 56, I wasn't really watching the draft. My mind was going into trying to calculate on what I'm going to do or how I'm going to maybe get to training camp or summer league and trying to start a career from there. So when 56 was called, I was watching the TV, but my mind was already gone. So all I remember is the people around me going crazy and, oh my God, this is you and everything. And I kind of blinked and looked and seen myself the highlight on the screen real quick. And I'm like, wait, this is me. Hold on. Does this mean hope? And it felt like a rewind experience of everything that I did at Rutgers and getting and watching the highlights. I'm getting the emotions of those games. But at the same time, I'm like, everything that I just said I was going to do is coming, is becoming real. Like I'm, this is the NBA draft. And it took a couple of minutes and you get happy. All right, I can say 10 years later, I don't care. I cried like a baby for a second and let it all out, because now this is even bigger than anything. Hold on. I'm in the NBA. My parents, I got to call my parents. So I'm calling my parents real quick, telling them, hey, I made it to the NBA. Now, greatest 15 minutes of my life. Boom, I've got it. And I get the phone call. And it's the Wizards. And word for word, it was, hey, Hamidi, how are you doing? I'm doing great. How is everything going? And congratulations on getting drafted. We are really happy for you and your family and everything. But thank you and all. But we don't think you should come to training camp. You think it would be a best idea for you to go overseas for a couple of years, and we will keep your rights, and whenever we'll bring you back, and whenever we need you, and you develop up there, we'll bring you back, and we'll see from there. And this is the first time I ever hear anything. I don't know. Mind you, I didn't really do the research. So now I blame myself for not having done the research. Actually, no, I don't. I love it. I love that I did this. But it was at the moment, it was a reaction moment where I looked at my agent and it was like, nah, I'm sorry, but I'm from overseas. I'm not going back. I'd rather come to training camp and get cut there, basically. But it was so, I reacted in the moment where it was like, and I remember the look on the people that were in the room with me, that was like, what did he do? And I'm like, nah, I really rather just, let me go to training camp. And if you guys don't want me, I accept it. But I'm not going back. In my mind, overseas is I'm going back to Senegal to play basketball, and they're going, I'm not thinking of going to Europe or any of those things. I'm like, no, I refuse to do that. I'm not going back. So, but things ended up really just that way. I went to summer league. I didn't play at all. No one really wanted me to play. We had six rookies on the team. I'm not calculating what the problem really was we have five or six rookies on the team. We have a team of my guy Gilbert, who just had that incident the previous year. You bring in the number one draft pick and all of those things, and you know the chaos that's going on in there. I'm coming in as the 56th pick. Obviously, the best deal for the NBA is to get rid of this guy who we're probably not going to use. You know, like, why would we have this guy here when we already have enough problems? Me, I'm not thinking of those things. I'm like, well, no, I want to learn in the NBA. And then if they get rid of me, even if it's just training camp, I got 3 weeks with NBA guys, and I can go play wherever after that. And that was kind of my thought process that night. But it was really kind of – it broke my high real quick when I got that call where I was like, yeah, I just got to the NBA, but wait, they told me they didn't want me. What does that mean? Like, I'm that bad? I thought I was pretty good. I know I just started basketball, but I kind of, this doesn't make sense to me. You understand what I'm saying? We're like, I worked my ass to get here, and now all of a sudden you're telling me that I don't belong. All right, there's something that doesn't click. So that was kind of the low of my night at that moment. And it was late. I was tired. So right away, right after that phone call, I got out and I was just like, hey, everyone, I appreciate everyone for coming, but I got to go to bed because I got work to do in the morning. And literally that's how it worked, because in my head I was like, all right, this means my job is definitely not guaranteed. They don't care about me. And I got to go prove to these people that I want to be here and I want to learn. So I got work to do. And that was immediately where the whole draft was like, yay. Okay, hold up. Let's not celebrate yet. We're not there. So, yeah, that was my draft.
You and Gilbert Arenas, I think, were teammates for like 2 months. That must have been an interesting time for you.
It was more than that.
He got traded, I think, midway through that year.
He got traded the next season.
Oh, the next season. Okay.
Or in the middle of the year, but it was more than 2 months. It couldn't be 2 months. It could not have been 2 months. No.
He got traded in December. In December.
Of 2010.
11? 10? I think it was
10. Nah, I wouldn't have. It would have been 11, I believe.
It had to be 11. Don't tell me 10, because I have too many memories with Gilbert for it to be 3 months of my life.
It was 3 months. It looks like it was 3 months.
I'll look it up. You tell us Gilbert Arenas' memories.
No, I'd rather him tell him. He's telling him himself. He probably don't even remember who I was as a 56th pick, but on some, that couldn't be 3 months.
December 18th, 2010.
Yeah. Wow.
Traded for Rashard Lewis.
That's just Gilbert Arenas' time. 3 months is just basically a year.
Who was your favorite Rutgers teammate? Who was your favorite teammate at Rutgers?
That's a tough question to ask him. Come on.
That's a tough question.
I know. I'm here to ask the tough ones.
He didn't say his least favorite.
I could ask who your least favorite was.
I don't have a least favorite, actually. I can't think of a least favorite. At Rutgers, least favorite teammate at Rutgers. And I'm gonna try. Yeah, I'm really gonna try to find one too. Like, if that's a possibility that I'm gonna. Yeah, this guy. I don't like him at all. He was bad.
Comedy. You're obviously like.
It was It was definitely Mike Kuhn. He probably didn't like Mike Kuhn. That probably was the guy you liked the least.
Charlie Rigoloso.
I'm sure you're like the. You know, you're the jokester. You're the one always messing with people. Was there a guy at Rutgers who you were like, I'm not going to mess with him. He takes everything maybe a little bit too seriously. Was there anyone on the team like that?
Adrian Hill.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't mess with Adrian.
Yeah, that's a good. Yeah, that's you're
that, right. That was you see how quick that was right there. That was the guy not to be met. And Adrian was he put those. Okay, I knew not to mess with him. Like, and if you seen him in the weight room, you would have been like, yeah, you're not messing with this guy. It didn't matter what he. I was like, what is he doing? I couldn't. I remember my freshman year, I couldn't even bench press the bar. I was learning to bench press the bar, and here goes Adrian with his three things on the thing. And then I'm never gonna forget this sentence. He goes, "I'm never gonna let a point guard bench press more than me." I'm never gonna let. That was it. That was one thing I still. I'm like, nope. Whenever I see someone in the weight room in my career lifting that can lift, I'm like, no, I got to get back in the gym. He can do it more than me. No, I'm not gonna do that.
Yeah, I feel like Ollie Bailey was on that team too, but wasn't. I feel like Ollie could put up some weights as well.
But see, I'm so glad you said that. I take my statement back. I take Adrian Hill back. But I can't say Ali was cool with me in some way. So I can't say Ali was like every single person I know was terrified of Ali Bailey. Okay. Every person I know was terrified of Ali. Ali was the realest G I've ever played with. That's it. You don't have no, he was the real. I was looking at what? No. That this is your reaction with him all the time. He's just like, you just did what? Okay. I'm not getting into it. That's your problem. That ain't me. You do whatever. That's Ali. I don't know what you got issues. Just say I'm sorry. That's it. My bad, G or something. Him? That was one of the realest guy I've met. But afterwards, as we spent time a couple of years together, he kind of got you get once you get once he lets you cool with him, then you kind of like in that territory of yeah. You on the other side now. That's your problem. But that's your thing. He likes me, not you. Yeah, man, I love him. Yeah, that was it. Favorite? I can't tell you what my favorite was because between Farmer, JR, and Griffin, we lived together for 3 years basically. Since I was the lone guy, they just put me with the class over me, and I stayed with those three guys damn near my whole career, and they were really like my family. J.R. Inman was Farmer as my point guard. That team was still some people I would love to like reunite just because we had that bond of on the court, we understood each other, and no matter what anybody said afterwards or whatever, I still have that same respect and love for them.
You're probably the only person who I would say I guarantee you have a better 3-point shot looking wise than is Jerron Griffin.
Jerron would shoot though.
He can shoot. It won't stop him. He'll make some, but I've never seen an uglier 3-point shot than Jerron Griffin's.
Yo.
I love those teams. Corey Chandler.
Yes. Yes. Corey. See? Corey was a problem. Oh, Corey. Man, we've had some people on our teams, man. You had Corey was real good. You had Chandler, Nelson.
Yep. Yeah. Courtney Nelson was on that team. Byron Joyner.
Courtney Nelson was on the team too. Yes. Earl Pettis. Earl
the Pearl.
Might be one of my favorite teammates at Rutgers.
There you go.
He's had that spot in my heart where he was just like, yo, Earl Pettis was that guy too. He was so mellow and chill. He had no issues with nothing and just about life and living and all those things. So I enjoyed when he got to Rutgers, I really enjoyed having him around. And even afterwards, we talked a little bit and everything. So, I actually really enjoyed being with Earl for sure.
I only have one more question for Hamdi. I don't know about you guys, but I Googled Hamdi Anjai Rutgers, and I scrolled down a little bit, and I'm seeing this picture of you in this suit with black suit with white polka dots and a silver tie. And I just want to ask, like, do you still have this suit? Do you still wear it? What's going on with this suit? Everyone listening, go Google Hamidi N'Jai Rucker, scroll down a little bit, and you'll see this picture of Hamidi in this suit with white polka dots. And I'm just, I want to know a little bit about the suit.
Okay, the suit was made by my mom. And cool. I can tell you my entire career at Rutgers, all my suits were made by my mom. And every year awesome. I wanted her to make something to represent Senegal in some way or Africa in some way. So every time I wore something, you had to be like, yo, this is it. I'm not just being the classical black suit or whatever. Put something on it. And I'm pretty sure I know exactly where that suit is. And all the rest of them, I found one not long ago. And I got some suits that are still in one of my friend's garage where I had my draft and everything. And where he's like, you're going to have to get rid of these things because you're never going to wear it again. But I'm still making, from her, most of my suits are still coming basically from Senegal. All the stuff I still dress up wise, basically, I kind of still make them from Senegal. Yep.
Hamidi,
I got to add the style to it again.
I heard that your Big East Defensive Player of the Year trophy might be living in New Jersey right now, or was like left in Northern New Jersey for a few years. What happened? You don't need it anymore?
No, it is still there. And it is exactly where I got my draft, where I got drafted. So that was, Corey asked to have it and hold it, and I told him that he can hold it for me because his family and I we just family, and it's like to me this is home, so I can have my trophy stay there indefinitely, and I'll be fine with it because it's still in Jersey, it's close to Rutgers. So in case they call me for something, I can come back and be like, hey, I still got the trophy, you know, just in case Rutgers still wants to holler at me, you know, I'm still here.
I think we need a night soon. You got to get back whenever things get going again. You got to get back to the rack one day. It has been, I mean, as they got Mike and Max can attest, last couple of years have been a lot of fun. It's probably everything you probably would have wanted when you were there. It would be awesome to have you back for one of those games.
I would love to. And I've actually, you know, when I came back to Rutgers, I think I've been to one of the games early in my career. I came back to one of the games, and it's a feeling to kind of get used to the emotions that that happened in the middle of the game where everyone just kind of stops and acknowledged that I was there. And I was just like, I'm not really used to that. You know, it's something that I don't know. I didn't feel like I deserved or whatever that was at the time. And I would love to just come back and be able to watch the game, you know, and everything. Because all my memories are really, my favorite memories are still on that court and everything. And I would love to just be there. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, H, we appreciate you giving us a lot of your time. We know you got some working out to do. Enjoy the southern part of France, which is where you are right now. And hopefully see you back in New Jersey in the rack sometime soon.
Absolutely. I
appreciate it, brother.
No, I really appreciate you guys, and we'll keep in touch and everything. Hopefully, I'll be there, and I will let you guys know because I want the flag to be joined with my jersey. So whenever I get back to Jersey, I'm going to make sure to send you a message and ask you the address because I want my jersey with it, and he will have it because that flag really represented a lot to me for my entire career. So, yeah, I want that to happen for sure.
That we'll easily make that happen. Flag, everything. That's perfect. We'll have it. We'll have a nice reunion. We'll make sure that everybody also wears the H Block party shirts as well too, from that night.
Hamidi N'Jai night at the rack.
You know, they still have it back in my village. I still have a lot of friends that are wearing those T-shirts, and I still have the cartoon, the block of my face. They all have it and everything, and it really. It feels great to know that moment actually happened because I wasn't expecting that either. I don't know if you guys know, but I never knew that was really going to happen. I heard that they wanted to do something special, but to come out with my family and see that everyone had the H t-shirt, and it was really hard to keep those emotions in. So yeah, greatest times. Love Rutgers.
Awesome. Thanks, H man. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you guys. Really.
So you just need me to say pay the players now, so you can put it on the back end, or like?
Yeah, sure. Say pay the players.
Pay the players, or you could put it. You could put the I have the.
Yes.
I have what's it called? The compilation of all the times I said pay the players. Just throw that in at the end. I could send that to you. The one I put at the end of the clip show.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. All right, I'll send that to you.
Do they all sound different? Or do they all sound the same?
No, they all sound different. You can hear there's like different. Sometimes there's music in the background. Sometimes I say it, and you know, pay the. I say in different tones and everything. Just use all of them.
I just want to say, you know, pay the players.
Mike just fucking stole your line.
That's what he deserved.
That was going to be the joke. Just take it.
Pay the players. Pay the players.
Pay the players. Pay the players.
Thanks. That's the end of the podcast. Pay the players.
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 Go, 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 shawty. It's your birthday. We gon' party like it's your birthday. We gon' sip a card and like it's your birthday. And you know we don't give a fuck, cause that's your birthday. Go find me a club, bottle full of bug. Mama, I got what you need. You need to feel the buzz. I'm into having sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, we into getting rough. You can find me in the club, bottle full of bug. Mama, I got what you need. You need to feel the buzz. I'm into having sex, I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug, we into getting rough.